From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
We've all been appalled by the pictures and stories of the devastating floods that have hit New South Wales and Queensland. More than 20 people have lost their lives. Thousands have lost homes, possessions, businesses. State and federal governments are coming under fire for responding too slowly or inadequately. The floods have fuelled the climate change debate, but they've also raised big questions about mitigation and planning laws. Mark Maund is from the School of Architecture and Built Environment at the University of Newcastle. He has qualifications in environmental science, urban and regional planning, and project management, and he's published numerous reports on environmental planning, development and infrastructure. He joins us today to discuss the response to the floods and the way forward. Mark Maund, how do you think these floods stand historically, that is, compared with the floods we've had in the past?
Michelle, unfortunately the proportion of the floods is quite significant. So we've seen quite damaging impacts in southeast Queensland and New South Wales. And comparatively, they are of quite a high standard and quite significant impact. And unfortunately, as we know, disasters are going to increase in severity and frequency over time. So they're quite significant floods, but I think we can unfortunately expect that floods of these sizes and other disasters to continue to affect our urban and rural environments. And this is really something that we're all going to need to respond to.
Can the severity of these floods be put down to climate change, or are there other drivers as well?
Yeah, so definitely climate change is one of the issues that we all need to deal with. And it's something that as a community and as a global network, climate change is a significant issue. However, there are another number of other issues that come into play as well. Where we choose to build our infrastructure and buildings is obviously one of the issues that we need to deal with. So as we choose to live and develop infrastructure in flood-prone land, then we consciously make these choices that we're exposing some of our buildings and communities to risk. So really, climate change is definitely one of the issues. We're going to have increasing severity and frequency of disasters. However, we can make some decisions, some conscious decisions within our planning framework and our building design framework that can alleviate some of these risks. And that's really what we need to focus on, as well as the really important issue of climate change. It's where we build, how we build, and what choices we as a community make, and what level of risk we're prepared to accept in these types of scenarios. So if we take the consideration of planning from kind of the development specific or location specific and really stretch that spatial boundary into a much broader network, then we can see that really from a community level or regional, even a national level, if we consider some of these issues in terms of where we build and how we plan our future communities, and we consider that as a national kind of focus, then we have that shifting thinking in terms of what risks are we as Australians prepared to accept and put communities at risk in some of these natural hazard prone areas.
Before we get into the detail of that, in general, how prepared were we for these floods? Were we as prepared as we could have been, or were there big gaps?
Oh, look, that's one of the excellent questions, isn't it? And that will come out of the analysis post, you know, the recovery phase. And during that, I'm sure that the emergency responders and the governments will be taking notice of some of the key issues and how we resolve some of those issues in this recovery phase. However, I do think that there's a couple of ways to answer that. There's some legacy issues around planning where we've chosen to put buildings and infrastructure and communities in these hazard-prone areas. And then there's current and future kind of planning for these future communities. So we have some planning standards that currently allow these areas to grow and develop. And that obviously increases the risk for people to live in these areas. So in terms of preparedness for these level of disasters, I think in terms of emergency response, we're getting better. We need to improve the facilities and services and support for our responders, because they are obviously the people who choose to go into danger to assist people. However, we also definitely need to make some really conscious decisions around how will our future communities look, what level of risk are we prepared to accept, what land use do we think is acceptable in these hazard-prone areas, and make these conscious decisions that potentially some areas that are high hazard risk, that are going to be exposed to future flooding, that we choose either not to develop in these areas, or we're very cautious around the types of land use that we put in these locations. And also we design our buildings and support our building designers, our planners in making the right decisions. And it's really very much a community focus in terms of, as a community, what level of risk are we prepared to accept? And we've seen that, you know, sadly, people have died. Emergency responders are putting their lives at risk. These are really the critical decisions that affect more than just the people who choose to live in these locations. And the choice of living in these locations is another issue.
On another front, on community, many locals feel let down and are blaming state and federal government, saying that we should not have to rely so much on local community people. Is this fair criticism or is this unrealistic?
The community has been fantastic, and they have in the recent response to disasters that we've had in Australia. I think it's a great testament to Australia that the community does come to help others who need help, and they can respond really quickly because they are local. So they have local knowledge. And we know from disaster recoveries and even preparedness that strong communities, strong social networks really assist with all phases of disaster, the disaster cycle. So it's great that the community is involved and they can respond really quickly because they are on the ground. It's actually quite a big activity to, in a number of cases, for instance, mobilise the Defence Force, mobilise other response agencies. I think it's a tough criticism to say that they didn't respond quick enough. I think as individuals, people are definitely, you know, as I said, in many cases, putting their lives at risk or going towards danger to help people. I think what we need to make sure is that they have the facilities, equipment, training and support when these disasters happen, because they will continue to happen, unfortunately, that they can respond as quickly as possible. So I think we're all involved in these decisions. We're all involved in being prepared. And I think it's important that we all actively support people who are responding as well as they can.
What about those who say that we need more permanent personnel to deal with these situations? Is that in fact practical? Because you could have quite a large number of people who stand ready, but not much work for them to do much of the time.
Yeah, and it's like anything. I think you can overcommit resources. So it's where the resources should be best applied. I think a number of things in terms of individuals. I think having reservists and support people trained who can come and provide assistance is great. As businesses, as government, we need to allow those people to take time off to do that training, support them in their time away from work so it doesn't cost people financially to go and provide this support. So I think that's one thing we can do. In terms of permanent people on the ground, I think, again, local is really important. But you can probably have too many people, and it's really how you focus their activities. I think if we improve preparation, then we'll improve, you know, and reduce the need for these response agencies as well. So I think just having responders waiting for the next disaster isn't the answer. It's part of a bigger picture that we need to be more prepared. We need to plan better. We need to understand the nature of these hazards and share information across all the states in Australia and territories. And it's really, I think, a bigger picture in terms of having resources and people being available. One thing I do think we really need in terms of infrastructure is evacuation centres. I think we need places, permanent places, even if they're multi-purpose, they can be used for other service facilities and activities. We really need evacuation centres for people to give them time to recover when these disasters happen.
Now, what about communications? Are our communications adequate to tell people, for example, that they need to leave quickly or to respond when people dial the numbers?
So again, I think we're getting better at that. The texts that go out from the SES to tell people to evacuate, the things like ABC radio become quite important in these types of situations because they're a reference point that people can look for information. Again, I think the communication can be improved. It can be potentially quicker and make sure it goes to all the right people. What do you do when the power goes out if people haven't got access to a radio or can't charge their phones? So there's probably ways we can improve what we're doing. And again, this is part of lessons learned and sharing information. So I think there is room for improvement. However, I think the core, you know, ideas and networks are there. We know that people need information. We know we need to warn people when it's time to evacuate, when it's too late to evacuate. We know all these things need to occur. We know this is information we need to share. There's probably opportunity for innovation. I mean, we're pretty good at innovation in Australia, and I think there's probably better ways to do things, but it's something we could all work together with telecommunication experts, with our emergency responders, with the community, the local community, how do they communicate, and really sharing that knowledge in terms of how to better communicate.
So do you think that the federal government should take the lead on this? Because some of these are, of course, state matters.
Yeah, so this is really a complicated issue. So we've seen that with a number of, national issues recently where we have the system of federal government and state and territory government. I think we do need national policies and a national approach. If that then means all those policies are adopted by state and territory governments, maybe that's one way to do that. But I definitely do think we need a nationally consistent approach, because disasters, hazard risks, these all cross borders. They're not worried about state and territory borders. You know, these are large-scale disasters, where, as we say, we increase the spatial scale of what we're looking at. We move beyond borders. Definitely, it is a national issue. So, yes, the Commonwealth government should take the lead. However, with support and information from state and territory governments, it's really that forming a national approach. These are too big for states and territories to manage alone, because, as I said, it all crosses boundaries and we all need to work together. I think as a community, we know that. And that national approach is the main focus. So it's really less about who takes the lead and more about how, as a nation, we come together and really work towards better outcomes for these situations.
Now let's go back to the reconstruction task that's ahead. You've argued that in this situation, a rush to rebuild is not always the best answer. Do you think that there should be restrictions on where people can rebuild?
I think this is now, and we've had this several times recently, we need to have that conversation definitely. These disasters will keep happening. We do have climate change. We do have increasing population in hazard-prone areas. As a first point, we need to take time and not rush to rebuild at the moment. That's part of the reason why I think we need safe evacuation centres or somewhere for people to go to get health advice, insurance advice, just to, you know, get back on their feet. Children need to get back to school, people need to get back to work, just to take time to make informed decisions. Other than that, in terms of the planning agencies and the building bodies and all the other agencies and groups involved in these decisions, yes, I do think we need to have a proper discussion around where should we live, what should we put in some of these locations. Otherwise, these issues will keep happening. The most important thing I think that sometimes we lose in some of these discussions is that some of these issues are too big for individuals to be able to manage. For instance, if we tell someone that they can't rebuild in a flood-prone area, that's a really big issue, because a home is for most of us the most expensive thing we have. So it's very, very difficult for an individual or a family to say, okay, well, we'll make this decision. It's really expensive. What we need to do then is empower and financially and socially and empower people to be able to make these decisions if they then decide that these too high risk for buildings, people, infrastructure in these locations, then it's up to all of us to help people, support people to move out of those areas. So that's involving the legacy decisions. In terms of future decisions, then yes, I do think we shouldn't increase population in a lot of these locations. But again, that's something that our planning policies and our legislation needs to follow. So it needs to support these decisions. And what does that then mean? We need really good access to really good quality information to make these informed decisions. So, however, as an overall summary, yes, I think some areas we need to now decide, look, that they're just too high hazard and avoidance is the best outcome or the preferred solution to a lot of these situations.
It's one thing, however, to say that in the future people can't build in a certain area, but it's another to say that somebody who already has had a house in this area has to either move or has to wait while planners consider whether the rules should be changed. Even taking account of your argument about better emergency centres, people could be tied up there for months while the whole bureaucratic system moves slowly and decision makers decide whether to change the rules. Wouldn't that be impractical? Do you need rules for new people and rules for those who've been there before?
Yeah, I do agree. I think in terms of any new development in high hazard areas, we need new rules, because we still have planning policies that allow people to move into those areas and in some cases encourage people to move into those areas. So definitely that's one thing that we need to move away from. We need to avoid some of these high hazard areas for any new development. In terms of people who currently live in these areas, it's a really challenging situation. So these are legacy decisions where, in most cases, in good faith, people have purchased a house potentially on the understanding that it's flood prone, potentially not, and made the assumption that, well, the house is there, so therefore it's safe to live in. They're disparate ideas around the same issue of what's an acceptable level of risk. People who are currently in some of these situations and locations, we need to give them support to move. This is a really big issue. Moving communities, moving individuals, moving families away from friends, school friends, employment, these are really tough discussions. However, the alternative is we put people back in these situations and floods happen again. People have died in these floods. It's really sad. And, you know, we're potentially exposing people to risk. So it's a really tough discussion. However, I think it's one that in terms of some of these historical decisions and where people currently live, we need to, between all of us, encourage people to potentially move away from some of these high hazard areas. Yes, it would be contentious. Yes, it would cost money. However, we really need to support people.
So perhaps you'd need some compensation scheme to enable them to do that.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, I think as a group, as a community, we can't rely on individuals or expect individuals to be able to afford to do this. They need support, and they'll need financial support and other types of support. And this is why it's a community-wide issue, and it's something that we all need to actively assist with. In many cases, people potentially live in these areas. So a lot of the places that are hazard-prone sometimes cheaper housing or less costly housing for these reasons, because they're hazard-prone. So therefore, people move into these areas because that's what they can afford, and they probably can't afford temporary accommodation. They can't afford to rebuild. They may not have been able to afford the insurance. So we're kind of adding to an existing problematic, you know, existing cost to people that can't afford any additional costs. So as a community, we need to support these people in moving to safe areas. I don't think it's okay to put people in areas of high hazard risk when, as a group and as a community, over time, we can start moving out of these areas.
Which takes us to the general question of insurance, and many people have said that they couldn't afford the insurance, so they're uninsured at the moment. Do you think insurance reforms are required, or if we stopped people living in these areas under your plan, would that problem solve itself?
Insurance is a really tough one. I think I'm not an expert in insurance, but it seems to, not the right word, but it seems to self-manage where these events happen. Insurance companies, you know, pay out where people are insured. Sometimes the cost of insurance goes up. If you live in a hazard-prone area, your insurance is probably higher anyway. So I think in many ways that the insurance industry is aware of these issues. But, and the flip side to that is, yes, correct. If people don't live in these hazard-prone areas, then the issue of insurance goes away as well, because it's really, the insurance is likely more affordable. To live in some of these areas, you end up paying higher insurance costs. So if you're not in these areas, your insurance costs go down. So yeah, look, insurance is a really big issue, but I think if we, again, avoid the risk, then we remove some of those insurance type issues.
Just finally, do you think the federal government learnt lessons from the big summer bushfires and applied them to these floods as far as they were relevant? Or do you think, once again, government failed to absorb the messages from one disaster, and so we go back to tours when we get a new disaster?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for the government, but it seems, the discussions at the moment seem to be moving away from previous discussions, I guess. We seem to be moving towards, and we've noted this, some of the people managing some of the emergency response agencies are saying, yeah, look, maybe we shouldn't now live in these areas. And for me, that's actually quite a shift. People haven't been quite as open about saying, maybe we shouldn't be here. Maybe we should think about where we build. And the discussion's been had before, but not to quite the degree, I think, that is happening now. So in response, I do think the lesson has been learnt. People understand that, you know, these are hazard-prone areas and it's a big issue. Was the response quick enough at the time? I think people did their best, and I think, again, we're learning. And in terms of planning decisions, which is really what we're talking about, where do people live? Where do we put infrastructure? Who makes the decision? How is the decision informed? Most planning decisions are really long-term decisions. So that's the challenge in terms of trying to change policy. The other issue we have is we don't have a Commonwealth planning agency that currently can direct planning across the country, which is really why I'm really would be encouraged the governments to have a national policy that addresses these plan consideration of natural hazards in planning. So again, that helps with this national approach. So as I say, I think the discussion is changing. It's changing because people are becoming increasingly aware of the impact that these hazards are having on the broad community. I mean, houses are being lost, people are being injured, sadly, people are dying. I think the lessons are being learnt. It's a really big shift in policy, and I think it's happening. Obviously, I would like it to happen quicker for this reason, that hazard risk is increasing as we move more people into these areas, and we have the issue with increasing frequency and severity of disasters with climate change. So, look, like most of us, I would like it to happen quicker. I think the government is listening. I think they're learning. This is a big transition. Look, a national planning policy approach, consider a national approach to natural hazards, to disasters, how we as a community decide what's an appropriate level of risk, what framework we make our decisions within. There's a lot of work to do. I think we're moving in the right direction. We need to move quickly to really try and avoid as much as possible these events happening in the future.
And of course, this planning authority would cover all sorts of disasters, floods and fires.
Correct. All hazards approach. And yeah, that's right. And sharing information, having experts involved, best available information, transparent decision making, national policy, national approach. You know, that would be, I think, a great next step for all of us, really.
Mark Maughan, thank you very much for talking with us today and sharing your insights. That's all from today's Conversation Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. We'll be back again soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.